We're glad you're here. Thanks for hanging out at Genesis. Welcome to National Hunter Widow Awareness Weekend. Anybody got any venison heading their way yet? Woohoo! meat, yes. This, if you have no idea what I'm talking about, it means that your neck is not nearly red enough. This is opening weekend of deer season here in Missouri, which, believe it or not, it was. I grew up in, you know, kind of traditional Baptist churches, and the state convention sent churches a calendar every year, and the calendar would show up, and it had all the events that were going on around the state that the convention had planned every year. And every year, there was only one date that was not a Baptist date. And that was the opening weekend of deer season. They put that on the calendar because if you, like here it's bad, but if you live like if you're in small town Missouri, there's three men in church this morning, anywhere out there. And they wanted to make sure you didn't plan some big event, some men's weekend on this weekend because they knew that, you know, they knew where the guys were going to be. Anyway, but we're glad you're here hanging out with us and all the deer are safe from you, so that's a good thing. But, you know, we know what those guys are doing. What about you? The last 48 hours or so, what's your life look like? What have you had in the rhythm of your life? Have you, you know, maybe on Friday, did you work? Did you do something Friday night? I went on a hot date with a smoking hot woman. It was a great time. Heidi and I, we went out and saw a movie together. Anytime you can get away from the craziness of the Hubbard home, it's a blessing. So we did that. And then yesterday morning, we had a soccer game. Of course, Josiah, last soccer game. Went and watched clump ball, is what I like to call it. Where there's a ball and 18 kids just kicking each other in the shins. And then yesterday afternoon, we had a little bit of free time, so we actually cleaned our carpets. We have a carpet cleaner thing, and no, I won't loan it to you, so we'll move on from that. But we cleaned our carpets and worked around the house and got, you know, quite a bit done. So it was kind of a work day. And then last night, I spent the whole evening doing two things, watching college football and working to try to get myself ready for all the craziness today. We have a members meeting, and there's just a whole bunch of stuff to hand out. And then this morning I woke up, and life was just nuts from the time. I actually got here the latest I've ever gotten here, because I was trying to get everything organized and ready so we could do all the stuff that I'll announce to you later. But my life has just been filled with this, that, and the other. And we as people, we want to know, you know, kind of the big questions. What is my purpose in life? Why am I here? Why do I exist? Well, your answer to that question is often answered if you just look back over the last 48 hours of your life. What happened the last 2 days? What did you do? Because we consume our life by the things that we tend to think is our purpose, that we tend to think are our values. And sometimes it's not, you know, all driven by that, but what we spend most time doing over a period of time really is a reflection of what we value, who we are, what we're about, what we think about ourselves, all that kind of stuff. Well, what we're doing is we're studying the book of Mark. It's a gospel, which means it's a story that was written by a dude named Mark, but he is telling us about the life of Jesus. And our text today, as we're going to look at, he's just going to show us a snapshot of 2 days in the life of Jesus, what happens in his life, the things that he does. And in a very similar way, the things that Jesus does in the 2 days shows us who he is, his mission, what he's all about. And what Mark's trying to do for us is he's trying to help us to see in this snapshot of these 2 days. He just kind of, basically he's priming the pump for the entire book. This is kind of a kickoff to all the things that Jesus will be doing during his earthly ministry. And Mark likes to keep the movie, the story moving really fast, keep the story hopping, keep it popping through so that it never gets bogged down. He just tells little snippets really fast. If you read the other Gospels will give us a lot more detail. But he's just trying to keep things moving. But he's going to show us 2 days in the life of Jesus. By looking at these 2 days in the life of Jesus, though, we're really going to see something much deeper about his mission. And today we're really going to look at kind of a little bit of our theology, our doctrine, what we believe about Jesus, because the text really helps us see very clearly what the Bible is showing us about who Jesus is. And, you know, Jesus actually, if you were to study culture from the 1940s through about the 1980s, Jesus was kind of unpopular. You had a lot of anti-spiritual, anti-Christian kind of sentiment. Well, that's actually switched. In the last 10, 15 years, there's been a really a big shift where Jesus is actually an icon in pop culture. And he is actually, you know, just kind of everywhere. Now, not necessarily the Jesus of Mark, but the Jesus of culture, he's just trendy. He kind of shows up everywhere. Kanye West actually had a song where the title of the song was called Jesus Walks. And after he made the song, of course, if you're familiar with Kanye West, he's an interesting figure. He kind of showed up in the news this week when he did an interview with Matt Lauer, and on one side was kind of apologetic about some things he said about Bush, and then he went and Twittered a whole bunch of nasty stuff about Matt Lauer. Really interesting. And if you know a lot about Kanye West, he's not somebody we'd allow to sing here on Sunday morning, if that makes sense. But he showed up on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine with a crown of thorns, and a caption that said that the passion of Kanye West. And you see, you know, the kind of the infatuation with the idea of Jesus. Jesus has made several cameos on The Simpsons and on other, like South Park. On South Park, Jesus keeps showing up, and he's either fighting Satan or Saddam Hussein. Actually, I had an episode where little scrawny Jesus and big giant the devil were in a boxing ring. And, you know, Jesus kind of shows up there, and he's, you know, kind of trendy and cool. And, you know, one of my favorites is Dog the Bounty Hunter. Has introduced Jesus to our society, and they start off praying, Jesus, we are here to serve you, and so we want to catch this fugitive, we want to beat him up, we want to take him down, we want to cuff him, we want to smoke with him, we want to then tell him about you, and we do all this because we love you, Jesus. And so, you know, he's kind of giving us a picture, Dog the Bounty Hunter, of what it means to have Jesus kind of at the forefront of what you believe and hold on to. Of course, Madonna and Brad Pitt, two of the true Christians of our culture, love to wear the Jesus is my homeboy shirt. That's one of their popular shirts that they wear. And then just recently, Justin Bieber came out, and he actually continues a long line of teen pop icons who claim Jesus in spirituality. Justin Bieber said, I'm a Christian. I believe in God, and I believe that I have a relationship, and I'm able to talk to him and really, he's the reason I'm here, so I definitely have to remember that, which is cool if he really understands that. It's just that what's really sad is in our culture, there is a long line of singers who made teenage girls and boys scream who said, I'm a Christian. If you're old enough like me, you remember Jessica Simpson saying that. And a lot of times, the culture, especially young pop culture, will embrace a Jesus that basically will just affirm their lifestyle, their values, and the idea that Jesus wants to make me rich and popular and famous. And that is the Jesus that they hold on to. Now, whether or not that's Justin Bieber's approach to that, I don't know. But we have seen several people come along and make similar claims. There's been more than 100 movies made about Jesus. Of course, the most recent that probably we're familiar with are The Da Vinci Code, where we were told that Jesus and Mary Magdalene were married and hooked up and had a kid. And then, of course, The Passion of the Christ, done by Mel Gibson, where the picture of Jesus dying on the cross was given to us in vivid reality. But one of the most interesting ones, there is a movie that is a Canadian kung fu horror comedy called Jesus Christ Vampire Hunter. Where, yeah, I'm not making this up, and you can Google it. It's actually a real movie where there's all these vampires in Canada, which that's a good place for them. And, you know, they're all dressed in modern day garb with fangs, and they're biting each other. And then Jesus Christ shows up in a white robe with a red sash, and he comes with ninja stuff and swords ablazing and takes out the vampires, because that's what we really need, is Jesus to show up and take out the vampires. And I haven't seen the movie, but I did watch the promo for it. They had like a 3-minute promo on YouTube. And laughed hysterically. It is rather interesting. And while I was there, I actually found another one that I thought was very interesting on YouTube. They have a short movie that is Jesus Christ versus the Terminator. Whereas, if you're familiar with the Terminators, Arnold Schwarzenegger as the Terminator can go back in time, and it's a time travel movie. Well, they decide to send the Terminator to the time of Jesus. And what's really funny, it's not like Jesus fights the Terminator, but Jesus keeps saying, listen, I came here for a mission, and you're messing up this mission. For example, in the Last Supper, they're having a Last Supper, and then the door flies open, and there's the Terminator, and they got a dude who looks like Schwarzenegger, right? And there's the Terminator looking, going, you know, and all of a sudden his eyes beat in on Judas. And he's going, must take out, bam, 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 bam. And he wastes Judas, and Jesus is like, no, this is why I came. I need to die for the people. And Jesus goes and lays hands on him, and Judas's chest glows, and Judas pops up, and then the Terminator, bam, bam, bam. It's this amazing, you know, he shoots him, Judas dies, and then, you know, Jesus lays hands, he pops up, happens like six times right in a row. And, you know, it's kind of the idea of, you know, the Terminator who's come to take out everybody who is in the way of Jesus being the Messiah, I guess, being the king or whatever. And so he was on a mission. It's interesting how our culture is into Jesus. We have a Jesus hot air balloon. There's a Jesus monster truck. Jesus has been on the cover of Popular Mechanics in the last 3 or 4 years. And of course, John Lennon once said, we are bigger than Jesus, meaning the Beatles. And then he went and met Jesus and went, ooh, I probably shouldn't have said that. If you study religious approaches to Jesus, you will find that everybody has an opinion about Jesus. Liberal Christianity will look at Jesus and say, Jesus was really a good man, but he wasn't really God. And so we need to follow his model, but we don't need to see him as God, and we don't really want to believe the miracles. Mormons will tell us that Jesus is the polygamous brother of Lucifer, who is becoming one of many gods. It's very interesting right now that the Mormons are coming out and really doing a very good job of amazing advertisement, and they like to present themselves as just part of mainstream Christianity. They really believe the same things that we do. They don't. And they definitely don't believe about Jesus what we believe. They believe that he is, you know, he had many wives at one point in time in an ethereal life, and he is the spirit brother of Lucifer, and he is working towards being a god who gets his own planet like the god of this universe got his. The Jehovah's Witnesses will tell us he is actually the Archangel Michael. Unitarian Universalists basically give us a Jesus who is the incarnation of Mr. Rogers, who is just all about making everybody peaceful and happy, and that he has a Christ or a God consciousness that kind of is in all of us and makes us all feel good. And we all kind of have that God consciousness within us, so we just kind of follow that and feel good about each other. And if we can just be peaceful, that would be wonderful. New Agers will say, of course, that he is God, but everybody's God. You're God, I'm God, we're all God. We all have divinity within us. And Islam really looks at Jesus, and they can't decide if Jesus is a prophet or an infidel, because if you read the Book of Mormon in one place, if you read the Quran, at one place in the Quran says that Jesus was a prophet, just not as important a prophet as Muhammad, but in another place in the Quran, the Quran says that Jesus was an infidel. And so it can't make up its mind, which is Jesus? Should we listen to him or get rid of him? One of the most interesting quotes in the last 150 years ago, philosopher Friedrich Nietzsche, who has had a massive influence on the philosophy of the way our culture sees things, and he is the one who basically said, God is dead. We've killed God. He said this about Jesus. He said, Jesus died too young, or he would have repudiated his views. And so the question that we always have in front of us is, Jesus. Okay, we throw out Jesus, we say we believe in Jesus, we trust, but what's Jesus? And what goes on in the world is that everybody is kind of into Jesus, but what we want is we want a Jesus that we can shape, that we can form, that will affirm who we are, who will kind of take my values, my attitudes, my beliefs, my actions, the way I live my life, and say, oh, I'm just soft, I'm fluffy, and I love you. But the problem with that is that when we have the right to form Jesus and decide who he is, then we do not have a Jesus who can really change us. Because the only way we will end up with a God, a Jesus who will really change us, is if we go to the scriptures and we find out who he really is and allow Jesus to contradict us. And what Mark is doing, you gotta understand what's going on as we read the Gospel of Mark, is that Mark is writing at the end of the lives of the original 12 apostles, the 12 men who hung out with Jesus, who heard from him, who knew him, including one specific guy, Peter, who was one of Jesus' closest friends, who was front and center in a lot of the stories. These guys are dying off. And up till this point, the message of Jesus entrusted his message to these 12 men, and these 12 men have been preaching for 30 plus years about Jesus. And they've been telling the stories and then applying the meaning. And now these guys are passing away. They are dying off. And the question is, how do we make sure the real Jesus is passed on? Because what was taking place in the first, end of the first century and into the second century are the same things that's going on now. Everybody liked the idea of Jesus, and they kept repackaging Jesus to fit their ideologies, their dreams, their ideas. And what Mark wants to say is, if we're going to have a Jesus that will change us, we have to have the real one. And in the text we're going to read today, we're going to get just a little bit about Jesus. We're going to get 2 days out of his life. So if you have a Bible, flip over to Mark chapter 1. And I'm just going to read the entire story. We're just going to walk through these 2 days, and I'm going to kind of come back and I'm going to unpack them. And then I'm going to make a couple applications or kind of a couple doctrinal statements that this passage is affirming, that is affirmed all throughout the Bible. Okay. So Mark chapter 1, we'll begin with verse 21. It says, and they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching. And they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority, not as the scribes. And immediately there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, what do you have to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. But Jesus rebuked him, saying, be silent, come out of him. And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying out with a loud voice, came out of him. And they were all amazed, so that they questioned among themselves, saying, what is this? A new kind of teaching with authority. He commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him. And at once his fame spread everywhere throughout all the surrounding region of Galilee. And immediately he left the synagogue, and he entered the house of Simon and Andrew with James and John. Pardon me. Now Simon's mother-in-law lay ill with a fever, and immediately they told him about her. And he came and took her by the hand and lifted her up, and the fever left her, and she began to serve them. That evening at sundown, they brought to him all who were sick or oppressed by demons, and the whole city gathered together at the door. And he healed many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons. And he would not permit the demons to speak because they knew him. And rising very early in the morning while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place, and there he prayed. And Simon and those who were with him searched for him, and they found him and said to him, everyone is looking for you. And he said to them, let's go to the next towns that I may preach there also, for that is why I came out. And he went out throughout all Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and casting out demons. A couple days in the life of Jesus. And what basically takes place here is, in the context of this, there's a key word that shows up in the passage. It's the word authority. What Jesus does, he begins to exercise authority over several different areas of our existence, of our experience. And that word authority is so key. It shows up in all the Gospels. All the Gospels talk about the authority, the power, the ability of Jesus. And so he shows up, and basically what happens, there's a couple different scenes here. The first scene, it says he went into Capernaum. This is a city. It's probably where Simon Peter lived. It's right on the banks of the Sea of Galilee. Beautiful city. The sea itself is just gorgeous right there. There are fish everywhere in the water. The area around it is full of a lot of farmland and vineyards, and it's just a beautiful area. Think Northern California. Think, these places where you would go to wineries, or you'd go out and just enjoy the countryside near a pretty big area of water. And Capernaum is just this type of city, and it looks like that probably Jesus had moved to this city, maybe even living with Peter and his family, staying in their house. We don't know that for sure, but he kind of sets up his ministry base from Capernaum. And it says that on the Sabbath, which is for them, it's on Saturday. The Hebrew day of worship was on Saturday. Ours is on Sunday. And on the Sabbath, Jesus shows up, as was his custom, and he went into the synagogue. And the synagogue, what happened about in the 400 years before Jesus is that the Jewish religion kind of got decentralized. For the whole Old Testament, Judaism, the Jewish religion, kind of took place in, the worship took place in a city and in the temple that was in Jerusalem. But because of the spread of Judaism kind of all over the world, the synagogue kind of took front and center. And a synagogue was basically a Jewish house of worship. It was a Jewish church. It was a place on the Sabbath, on their day of worship, they would show up just like you were doing. They would listen to the scriptures, they would pray, and somebody would teach them. And often they would have a group of people that were there to kind of oversee the ministry of the synagogue. Those people were from the Old Testament tribe of Levi, or they were called Levites. But they also had people who were gifted teachers within the synagogue. And sometimes, it would just be a whole bunch of different people in the church would take turns teaching. But they also had a bunch of itinerant preachers. People would just show up, and if somebody showed up who kind of was a gifted preacher, they'd just say, hey, all right, you're up, go for it. And so Jesus shows up on a Sabbath, and he comes in, and immediately they put him up on the stage and say, hey, man, we've heard that you teach. We heard that you got a good word to say. You start teaching us. And Jesus stands up, and he begins to teach them, and look at what it says. And here's where the word comes out. He says, verse 21, immediately on the Sabbath, he entered the synagogue and was teaching, and they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one who had authority, not as the scribes. Now, here's what's going on. This is what he means. He says they taught as one having authority. That word authority is a word that means both power and right. It's might and right. It means that somebody has the strength to do something, but he also has the responsibility or the right to do something. And here's what's going on. They're saying that Jesus, when he taught, there is something different about the way he teaches. He's not like the scribes. Now, the scribes were a Jewish group of people whose one sole responsibility was to make sure that the scriptures got passed on correctly and interpreted correctly. Their job was to take, because we didn't, you know, they didn't have printing presses. They didn't have nice, neatly bound, you know, Bibles like we have. They weren't able to put Bibles at the end of the rows and say, hey, if you need a Bible, grab one, pass it down. They had scriptures that were hand copied. That's all that they had. And the Jewish people had a passion to say, the scriptures that we have, God gave us. We cannot mess this up. We cannot corrupt these scriptures. And so they wanted to make sure that they passed them on correctly. And they had a group of people, the scribes, whose job was to take the scriptures, to take a copy of the Bible and to open up a piece of animal skin or parchment and make copies. And the way they would copy is they would go to the Bible, they would open it up, they would unroll the copy of, say, the book of Isaiah, and they would begin with the very first letter. And they didn't copy word for word, thought for thought, phrase for phrase. They would make copies letter for letter. And they would take a page and they would go over here and look at a letter, and they'd come over here and write that letter. They would come over here and look at a letter. They would come over here and write that letter. They would come over here, look at a letter. They would come over here. They just kept doing that. And anytime they came to the name of God, they had a special pen and they would stop. They would pronounce the Shema, which is, Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God. You will love the Lord with your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. And then they would reach over and take this pen and they would write the holy name of God, which they weren't even allowed to pronounce. Then they would put the pen back and they would go back. And when they got done with a page, they would begin to count letters. And they would count the number of letters on the page. And if the numbers matched up, then they would count to the middle letter. And if the middle letter matched up, then it was an approved copy. This was their job. Okay, this is what these guys did with their lives. And because of that, they'd become experts. They knew the scriptures backwards and forwards. You're right and you're memorized. It's just, and so these men would stand up and they would do the same thing I do. They would stand up and say, I'm nothing, but let me tell you, I'm gonna teach to you from the scriptures. And as I open the scriptures, God has spoken. Let me explain to you what these scriptures mean. But Jesus shows up and there's something different. The authority of the scribes came from the Bible, God himself through the scriptures though. They didn't have their own authority. But Jesus stands up and he begins to say phrases like this. We find this in Matthew. You've heard it said, do not commit adultery, but I say to you. And he begins to say this phrase. And his teaching, people are wowed because instead of saying like the scribes do, let me tell you that my authority, my backing is not my own. It comes from somebody else. He stands up and begins to say, listen, I speak to you. I preach from my own authority. The scribes would stand up and they would begin to teach 1,000 years of interpretation. They would say, Rabbi so-and-so believes that it means this, and Rabbi so-and-so believes that it means this. And I'm just quoting all these people. Jesus didn't quote other people. Jesus just stood up and said, let me tell you what I'm going to tell you. And the people were awed. There was something about the way he preached that said, this man has both the right to say what he's saying and the might to say what he's saying. And as he's preaching, people's hearts are being challenged. And the Bible says that they are amazed, but they don't get him. They don't know who he is. But there's one, and it's the person we don't expect who does get him. And so the first area we see Jesus having authority is in his teaching. But the second thing we see is that Jesus has authority over unclean spirits. Look at what happens. Jesus is teaching, verse 22, it says, immediately there was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, what do you have to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. I mean, that would be really interesting. I mean, we like, you know, if you went to like a charismatic church or an African-American church where, you know, people amen and they were preaching, somebody stand up and doing this, but can you imagine in here? I mean, we're kind of quiet. We're, you know, kind of subdued, kind of laid back, and, you know, about the best I ever get is, can I get a harumph out of you, harumph, hey, I didn't get a harumph from you kind of stuff. I mean, you know, it's just kind of quiet and subdued. Can you imagine just, you know, all of a sudden in the middle of our crowd, somebody, and I won't pick on anybody, although there's a couple of you I would like to call out right now. Somebody stood up and said, you know, started speaking, and, you know, their head spinning around backwards, and they, you know, all of a sudden we got the scene from The Exorcist right in the middle of our church. You know, and it's shouting up at it, not at me, but in the story. I mean, it's just like a service like this. And all of a sudden, this dude goes, what have you had to do with us, Jesus? And he's shouting at him with this voice, you know. And all the people are like, bro, where'd you come from? You've been hanging out here, and you're an usher. And what is going on, dude? And there's something really interesting here, okay? Because we think the people who are demonized are going to be out there. There's something that is happening here that we need to know, and that is this. There are always among any people of God, people who don't get it, who really their influence is not from God. They have a different Jesus. They have a different idea of God, and they have given themselves away to a spiritual dimension, and they hide among the people of God. But when Jesus shows up, they are exposed. And what's going on here is that this man has probably sat in the synagogue week after week and listened to the preaching, listened to the teaching, but there's something going on. He has a spiritual dimension of oppression that is just kind of to the next level. Now, I just kind of got to warm you up here and tell you that we are going to have a sermon a little bit later that looks very specifically at this whole idea of demons and of the devil and of hell and of what the Bible teaches about possession, because we're going to run into one dude who has like a whole slew of demons hanging out and partying on the inside of his life, okay? And so I'm not going to spend a lot of time, but just let me kind of give you a precursor what the Bible is picturing here with the demons and why so many show up with Jesus. And just the first thing I want to tell you is that the Bible shows us that there is a spiritual dimension to this world. That we have been so influenced by modernity, by the modern movement that says if the only thing that's really real is what you can see, taste, touch, feel. If you can't prove it in the scientific lab, we're not going to buy into it. And it's kind of like we hear about demons and angels and devils and all that kind of stuff, and we kind of go, well, I can't quite believe in that. But the truth of the matter is that the Bible is very clear to show us that there is a spiritual dimension to life, and that spiritual dimension does have beings that are trying to influence us. And they're beckoning out to us, and they're calling to us saying, listen, you can believe in Jesus if you want to, as long as you buy into this too. And the Bible tells us that there are literally doctrines of demons, that there are demons who are crying out, and a demon will become anything you want it to be. It will promise you anything. It will call you to anything as long as it will pull you away from Jesus. And there are influences in our life where we literally are embracing demonic ideas from people who just sound really good. And we don't want to acknowledge that there is a spiritual dimension to what's going on in the communication that they have. But the Bible tells us we need to be very aware that behind every idol, behind every sinful attitude, behind every rebellion, behind every area of wickedness, there is a spiritual dimension with real spiritual beings, with real spiritual ideas. And if you're like, I don't know how to buy into that, I'm not really sure what to say, let me just encourage you, and when we get to this sermon, I will pull this book out and probably quote it several times, but there's a book by a dude named C.S. Lewis called Screwtape Letters, where he is amazing at explaining kind of this dimension, as he kind of in an allegorical form tells the story of two demons who are having a conversation over a dude who just became a Christian. And they are trying to figure out how to keep this guy who became a Christian from having an unfruitful Christian life. And everything in that book is so incredibly true. And I think what C.S. Lewis is trying to say is, as I feel these spiritual forces, they are not just made up in my mind. There are real spiritual activity going on behind my life that's trying to keep me from living my life for the glory of God. And they're subtle and they're secretive. But for some people, they literally come to a point where they totally give themselves over to that. And when they totally give themselves over to that, there is a level of demonic activity in your life that just, it goes to the next level. And there's two dangers here. When we deal with the demonic, the satanic kind of stuff, danger number one is to ignore it and act like it doesn't exist. And danger number two is to see a demon under every rock. We need to find ourselves where the Bible is, where it shows us this is real, but the answer to this is to serve and to trust and to pursue Jesus. But to realize that there are probably even some things in our own lives that there is demonic oppression, and we need to pray against the effects of the devil. We need to pray prayers that say, God, I claim the authority of Jesus. I don't have my own authority, but I claim the authority of Jesus, and I pray over my household, and I bind the devil, and I bind his effects, and I give my life to you, and I'm resisting the devil. James chapter 2 tells us, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. I am resisting the devil and living for the glory of God. And so what happens in this story is that there's this dude who he has pursued things in his life to the point where he has listened to demons, and now they literally have filled his life, and there is a level that you know, we call oppression or possession by the demons, and there's a spiritual dimension, and now this demon is being confronted by Jesus. The demon has been silent. The guy probably doesn't even know the strength of the influences in his life until he's sitting in the service. And now these things that are on the inside of him going, I know who that is, and I'm not messing with him. And they begin to shout out at Jesus. And now everybody in the service who's been listening to Jesus teach are now like, Joe, what the heck are you doing? As he has, you know, got the head spinning around and the weird thing, you know, the whole exorcist thing going, as he is walking down the aisle, pointing at Jesus going, what have you have to do with us? We know who you are. And it's really interesting as we read the Bible, okay? In fact, the book of Mark, like all the way up to the cross, there is only one group of beings in the book of Mark who know exactly who Jesus is until his death. You know who those beings are? The demons. The best Christology in Mark comes out of the mouth of demons. His own disciples, the Bible, Mark's going to keep telling us, they don't get it. They don't get it. They don't get it. But the demons know who he is. You know why they know who he is? He's already kicked their butt. He's already beat them. He beat them out of heaven. They turned as created beings. Jesus, who is God, created them, and they turned and went, we don't want a God, we want to be God, and they've already had their butt whipped once by Jesus. They know they can't take him. And now Jesus stand there preaching, and everybody else looks at him and goes, here's just a dude who's got really cool teaching. But the demons see him and go, ah, we've tangled with him before. We don't want that again. We got to figure out how to get out of this. And the demons, while people are amazed, demons are terrified. They are screaming. You know, Halloween just passed, right? And, you know, the whole haunted house, we had, you know, one of the best ones in St. Louis, so to say, here in Eureka. It's just down the hill from my house. I could hear people, you know, and even some nights when it was kind of quiet in my neighborhood, I can hear kind of the moaning and groaning and see the light and all this kind of stuff. And we go in and there's all these pictures of demons who try to scare us. Well, you know what Halloween is for the demons? It's when Jesus shows up. They are more afraid of him than we are of the demons when we go to the haunted house. Halloween for the demons is when Jesus shows up. They are terrified of Jesus. And he begins to call out to this man, and look at what happens. He says, what have you to do with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God. Jesus rebuked him, saying, be silent, come out of him. And the unclean spirit, convulsing him and crying out with a loud voice, came out of him. So now the demon is afraid of him, but Jesus literally shuts the demon up and casts him out. And we see this often. We'll see Jesus making the demons be quiet. They know who he is. They start to promote it. But what Jesus doesn't want, he doesn't want his main source of publicity to be from the mouths of demons. Okay? You know, he doesn't want people who are demonized running around going, Jesus is in there, don't go in there. It's really cool, but don't go, you know. He is shutting the demons up. They know who he is. They have the best Christology in the book of Mark, which means they have the best understanding of who Jesus is, the best belief system, but he does not want his source of publicity. You know, we do not, as you know, Cardinal fans want Cub fans going around going, yay, Cardinals. I mean, it just doesn't work. He does not want a source of publicity coming out of the mouths of demons. Because he knows that all that will lead it to is a freak show. And Jesus does not want to be the freak show. And so he silences the demon and he commands it. And Jesus shows his authority. He has right and might over demons. Okay? But not only this, we also find out that Jesus has both right and might over sickness. Verse 29, it says, immediately he left the synagogue and he entered the house of Simon and Andrew. James and John and Simon's mother-in-law lay ill with a fever, and immediately they told him about her. He came, took her by the hand, lifted her up, and the fever left her, and she began to serve them. And here in Mark's gospel, the first person Jesus heals is Peter's mother-in-law, which for Peter may have been a good thing or bad thing. We're not sure. Ooh, that's wrong. You know, Peter may have been going, oh, let her be, man. She's in the room and she's quiet. That's the best option, okay? But Jesus goes in and he heals her. Some of you guys are like, I'm totally offended at this service now. I just can't go on. Jesus heals, and this is just the first time. We're going to see this a lot, that Jesus has this authority. He has this right in his mind over people's illness. He's going to heal a lot of people. And as he heals them, they're going to be restored to health. We kind of see the reverse of the fall. The fall brought, you know, our sinfulness in the fall brought brokenness in the world. And disease is kind of a picture of that. And Jesus is reversing that in the lives of people. And he heals people. He has this power, this beautiful power over sickness. And then it goes on to tell us, verse 22 says, that evening at sundown, they brought all to him who were sick and oppressed by demons. Now, the question is, why after sundown? The answer is because if you were a Jew, the law said you couldn't go for walks during the Sabbath. Okay, if you remember, this day started, it's 2 days in the life of Jesus. This day started with Jesus on the Sabbath. And they had all these laws that were made up by the religious people of the day that basically said, here's what you can and can't do on the Sabbath. You can't work, and walking too far, doing certain things is work, so you can't do that. And so the Sabbath, though, for Jewish people, their day is from sundown to sundown. We kind of live sun up our day, and our clock says it begins at midnight. But really, our day begins when, the alarm clock goes off in the morning and you begin the process of day. But in Hebrew thought and life, sundown to sundown was a day. And so when the sun went down, it meant the Sabbath was officially over. Now they could come out of their houses and show up at the house, and they came to find Jesus. And now Jesus is just ministering. He's loving these people. He's giving compassion. He's serving them. He's healing people. He's casting out demons. And all this battle, this warfare that is the world that we live in has now confronted Jesus face to face. And Jesus is demonstrating his authority, his right and his might over these things. And then the last thing we see Jesus demonstrating authority then is over his mission. It's very interesting, kind of subtle. Let me explain this to you. Chapter 1, verse 35 says, rising very early in the morning. So here we have the next day, and before sunup, Jesus, while it was still dark, he departed and went out to a desolate place, and there he prayed. One of the interesting things, if you ever want to do a really cool study in the Bible of prayer, go study when Jesus prays and what happens. There are several places in the Bible where Jesus leaves in the middle of the night and he goes and prays. And in most of those stories, the next day, amazing things. Jesus is walking on water, feeding 5,000, and eventually he is dying on the cross, okay? But here, he goes to a desolate place. He goes out by himself before it's sunup, and he prays. That's a challenge to us. I'm not saying that you have to follow Jesus' rhythm. You know, my philosophy is if I get up before sunup, you know, there needs to be a shotgun in my hand, right? And the idea of getting up early is hard. But sometimes it is a good idea to say, listen, I need to get along with God. As I was reading this week, I've been sick. I've been working on, my paper for a thing. And so those of you know, I've been working on my doctorate. I've been a ton of hours at that, and I'm teaching school and all that. And I feel kind of depleted spiritually. Just gut honest with you. I feel kind of depleted. And it's showing up. As I was coming to church this morning, it's showing up in my life. You don't need to know how. It is. And I got to thinking about this, and I said, it's been a long time since I slotted 2, 3, 4 hours just to get alone with God. Here's the deal. If Jesus needed it, so do I. So do you. It says he got alone to pray. Verse 36, and Simon and those who were with him searched for him, and they found him and said to him, everyone is looking for you. Jesus, everybody is seeking you out. And he said to them, let us go on to the next towns that I may preach there also, for that is why I came. And he went throughout all Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and casting out demons. Now, it sounds like that the disciples show up and they're looking for Jesus. They're like, oh, there he is. Hey, Jesus, come on. I know you're praying. That's cool, but you need to come with us. Everybody's looking for you. But Mark is actually giving us a clue into the conflict between people and Jesus. And here's what is going on, okay? When Peter says everybody is looking for you, it's not just, oh, Jesus, it was fun yesterday, and we want to have another fun day today, and there's a whole bunch of people who want to be healed. The idea that is going on here is that everybody wants to own Jesus. If you study and kind of come at it from this angle, the different groups in the New Testament, there are actually about 8 or 10 socio-political groups that show up in the New Testament. There are groups like the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Zealots. There are the Herodians. There are the Hellenists, okay? And if you took my New Testament class at any point in time, we would spend a whole week teaching you all these people. But since I only have a certain amount of time, I'm just gonna tell you, all these people are influenced by social, religious, political ideas at the time, but they're all different. Every group is different. Every group has their idea of what the perfect world would be, and if we just had a Messiah who could help us with this, it would work. And for a season, every group wants Jesus to pick their team. If you study it closely, what happens is they come and they begin to ask Jesus questions, and the original questions are, Jesus, we know you're on our team. We just want to confirm that. What do you believe? And what Jesus, every group he ends up talking to, whether it's the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Herodians, the Zealots, I mean, it doesn't matter who he's talking to. Every group he is talking to, instead of saying, I'm with you, the question is, no, are you with me? The question is, he basically opposes the idols and the arrogance of every group, and every group hates his answer so much that every group comes to Jesus going, he's on our side. Just watch, I'm gonna ask him a question. He's on our side. Hey, Jesus, what do you think about this? And Jesus answers, and they walk away going, we gotta kill that dude. That's the story, that's what goes on. Every group, when Peter says they are looking for you, it's not just, oh, Jesus, everybody had such a good day yesterday. Every group wants to pigeonhole Jesus to say, are you on my team? And Jesus' answer in Capernaum to the question, are you on my team, is, we're leaving. It's time to leave here. There are gonna be people in every group who look at Jesus and go, we believe. There are gonna be a whole bunch of other Jesus who try to take Jesus and pigeonhole him to make him into the Jesus they want him to be. And what we're gonna find all through the Gospels is that when it reaches that point in any city, Jesus has made a whole bunch of people mad, and he says, we're done here, we're moving on. Because nobody's gonna control the mission of Jesus, because the mission of Jesus was not to support their political ideas, it was to die for their sins. And he says, we need to go preach the good news to another city now. It's time to go. Because that's what I came for. And he has authority. Nobody else is gonna have authority over his mission. He has authority. Now this idea of authority, here we go again. He has authority over his teaching. He demonstrates that his teaching is from something else. He has authority over demons. He has authority over sickness. He even has authority over his own mission. And anytime we deal with authority, the big questions that we ask, I mean, you don't do this like in your head cognitively, but you ask these three questions anytime you see an authority, okay? Hop in the car and start driving. And most of us, when the speed limit says 65, we go 70, 75. Some of you teenagers are like 90. And we pass a car that has lights. And we immediately, we don't ask it in these format, but this is a question that's growing off. Does this guy have the power to stop me? Does he have the right to stop me? And where does authority come from? In other words, does he have the power to stop me? Does he have the ability, the strength to do what authority calls him to do? This is why, like, those of you, you know enough about Andy Griffith, this is why we love to laugh at Barney Fife. He wore the badge, but he didn't have the strength to pull it off, right? He's always dropping his gun and had the one bullet and the whole nine. We just knew Barney Fife was not gonna be able to pull it off when it counted, okay? He did not have the strength even though he had the badge. Some authority, it's not that they don't have the strength, they just don't have the right. So I like my neighborhood, I live on top notch, but they call it cop notch, right? Because literally in my neighborhood, at one point in time, they said there were like 18 or 19 county policemen that live in my neighborhood. And there is a group of hellions that also live in my neighborhood that literally will walk around the middle of the night and will hit garage door openers and cars and steal people's beer out of their garage. Now, if you live in a neighborhood where there are 18 or 19 policemen, you would think people would be afraid, but they're not. You know why? Because they're St. Louis County cops, they're not Eureka cops. They don't really have jurisdiction over our neighborhood, and they're not afraid of them. But then the third question that kind of goes is, where does the authority come from? And the reason we look at police officers, we go, there is a whole system of governance behind the badge that they wear that represents them, but their authority is from someone else. Well, Jesus, what we see in a story is he has both the right and the might, but the question that people are answering is, where is his authority from? And that's the big idea of this and the rest of the New Testament. Who is Jesus? What do these 2 days teach us about the life of Jesus? And there's two simple things that you may have even heard before. You may have even, you know, sat in a class and had somebody explain to you or say, but I just kind of want to unpack it real fast about what this is saying about Jesus. And the first thing we find, from the life of Jesus, that this man is God. That Jesus is fully and completely God, that this man is more than just a man, that his authority does not come from somebody else. It comes from the fact that he is the one who called the universe into existence. He is the one who was there in Genesis chapter 1 and said, let there be light, and there was. His authority comes not from a system of religion. It comes from himself. He is the ultimate authority. He is the God that is. Now, In the idea of God, there's all kinds of ideas of God, but we have to wrestle with the idea of the Hebrew concept of God. Because the Hebrews, the people who we got the Bible from, interacted with the one true God. And they said, listen, there is one God. And that God is creator and sovereign over all. In fact, I already quoted it to you once, but in Deuteronomy, there was a verse that was taught to the youngest of children. It's called the Shema. It is their pronouncement. It is the way they would open their day and close their day. It was the words that a scribe would say every time he came to the word for God. And it goes like this. Deuteronomy chapter 6, it says, hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one God. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your might. Hear what he's saying? The Hebrew people, their confirmation, there is one God who is over all, and our purpose for life is to love that God with everything that we are. That's how life has meaning. And when Jesus shows up, he begins to live his life. The people are curious about him because he has an authority, but that authority, they're wondering where it comes from. The answer is it comes from himself. He is the same one who created all, who is all. And it was hard for those people to grasp because how can this dude be God? But the whole story of Jesus is showing his authority over every realm of life, demonstrating that he is the one who is behind it. He is God. And what we find is several passages, and these are just a few real quick that affirm this. John chapter 1, verse 1 and 14 says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Now, what John's doing with this passage is he's using this Greek word that is translated word as a synonym for Jesus. So you could read this. In the beginning was Jesus, and Jesus was with God, and Jesus was God. He goes on, verse 14 says, and the Word, or Jesus, became flesh and dwelt among us. And we have seen his glory, glory as the only Son from the Father, full of grace and truth. John begins his gospel with this declaration that this dude who hung out among us, he's God. There's another point where Jesus is having a conversation with the religious people. And he looks back to the story of the Old Testament, and there's this dude named Abraham who met God. And then another story of a guy named Moses who saw God face to face in the story of this burning bush. And in the story where Moses interacted with God, God literally said, here's what I want my name for all of history to be. I want to be known as I Am, the great I Am. And the Hebrew name for God, hear, O Israel, the Lord, our God, the Lord, comes from this. The Hebrew name for God is a derivative of the Greek or the Hebrew word I am. Jesus is showing up, he's hanging out, and he's having this interesting discussion with the religious leaders. He says, here's the deal. Abraham knew me. And the people are like, all right, bro, Abraham lived 2,000 years ago. You're 30, you're not even 50 years old. How can you say Abraham knew you? Jesus' response is very interesting. Look at this. Jesus said to them, truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am. See what he said? He's saying, hey, yo, Pharisees, religious leaders, you know the story of Moses, the burning bush, that whole deal where Moses showed up and got the Ten Commandments later on, and he kept hearing the voice of God? Boys, that was me. That was me there. Look at their response. It says they picked up stones to throw at him, but Jesus hid himself and went out to the temple. Why'd they pick up stones? Because a man just made a claim that he was God. You don't do that as a Jew. Now, for everybody else, that's a sin. but it's not for Jesus because he is. And then at the end of Jesus' life, he's crucified, he rises again, and a guy named Thomas comes up, and he's, you know, the story of doubting Thomas, familiar with this, and he shows up, and Jesus is post-resurrection, and he tells Thomas, put your finger here, see my hands, put your hand, place it in my side, do not disbelieve, but believe. Thomas answered him, look at this, my Lord and my God. Now, if Jesus isn't God, he's gonna go, Thomas, don't say that, but he doesn't. And what we have is in this passage, and we see in the life of Jesus, this truth worked out that the very God of the universe is now shown up in human form and he is living among the people, that Jesus is our God. This is why we look to him, we pray to him, we trust him. But the text also shows us a very beautiful thing, that Jesus also became fully human. We see a Jesus who teaches, who loves, who cares, who interacts with people. He's hungry, he's thirsty. And in this text, it's really beautiful. Where we see it is that he stops and he prays. There's a conversation going on between Jesus and the Father in a prayer dimension. Now, as we unpack this idea, the biblical term is the incarnation, that God became human. This is just bigger than us. I mean, it's outside our capability to grasp. We are gonna have points of tension in our understanding of God. Because if we understand it all, our God is pretty small. But what the Bible keeps showing us is, here's this guy, he is completely human. He has all the characteristics and attributes of humanity. And in this man is a person who has all the character and attributes of God. By affirming his divinity, we say, listen, salvation comes from the Lord. But by affirming his humanity, we say we have somebody who came as our representative. By affirming his divinity, we say that God has come and entered into our story. He has not left us alone. By affirming his humanity, we say, but we have somebody tangible to follow. And so what the Bible is going to show us, and what we have to come to the point and believe, is that this man is God. In a couple days in the life of Jesus, we learned that. We learned that this dude walks around, hangs out, lives, but he has authority. And his authority is not from something else. It is the authority of the one who spoke the world into existence. See, we don't want to end up with a Jesus of our own making. He won't change you. But we need to find the Jesus of the Bible, because the Jesus of the Bible is to show us this man who is God. And it is in that our brokenness, our idolatry, our sinfulness, our sickness, our demonizing, the things in our lives that can't be fixed, it is in this man who is God that we have ultimate hope. And this whole book of Mark is going to call us to see him clearly. And that's what we want to do. We want to worship the true Son of God, Jesus, the man who is God. I'm going to pray, and we're going to sing and celebrate that Jesus. We're going to sing to him and worship him, because he is our hope. He is our glory. He is our dream. He is our value. But here's the challenge. The last 48 hours, what did your life look like? Let me ask you a question. In the last 48 hours, other than right now, is there anything that says, Jesus is my God? Lord, we love you, we praise you, we come to you, you are our God. And I just pray that this morning, as we sing and celebrate Jesus, you will work in us and transform us and call us to yourself and help us to realize the greatness of Jesus over us and in us. And I just pray that you will do a mighty work in us as we see you as our God, that we don't embrace a spirituality that just kind of reforms you into our image, but that we humbly bow our knee before the one who is God, and see you in clearness, and realize that who you were is also who you are today, because you are eternal. In your name I pray, amen.